Accession number 30419, reel 16.
So, having emptied the aeroplane, we flew back, and we had the Doppler still telling us where we were, so it was pretty easy flying back. We relaxed a bit, smoked a cigarette, and then I can remember the captain said, "You have control, your approach and landing." So I found myself over Batu-Lawi, having to fly the aeroplane back to Labuan. Of course, I was delighted. I was being given something to do, Kathy, and a chance to land an Argosy at Labuan after the first supply drop the squadron had done. And so I'd better get it right. And the trick was, with the Argosy, that you wanted to do as near as you could a constant power approach. The engines like to be left alone, really, constant speed propellers, so they'd adjust their pitch themselves and keep the RPM. But you had to set the power to where you reckoned it needed to be to land, to come down on the approach, and then just cut the throttles back as you came over the threshold. I didn't do it this first time, but that was what we were aiming for. And I handed the radio log to the captain. Captains never mind. Captains rather like using the radios. So the captain had that responsibility. The navigator told me where we were and how far it was to go. And, of course, the engineer was his own man anyway. He had a lot of responsibility, knew what was going on. So I really had to point it in the right direction. And we knew what, we could see everything. I could see Brunei. I could see Kinabalu over there on the right, quite a long way away, but a huge massive mountain. And you had Brunei Bay pointing you to Labuan. And the trick was to come back and join the circuit at 1,500 feet. And, oh, that's right. Yeah, 1,500 feet, you come in on the circuit and let down and come in and land. But they said, as we were coming over Brunei Bay, that we were clear for a straight-in approach. And that gave me the opportunity to do this constant power approach. I didn't do too badly. I was flying it from an early stage, took the autopilot out to get the feel of the aeroplane. And when you come into Labuan from the south, you're coming in over the sea, so you've got the threshold just over the seashore. That's a bit trickier to judge, and if you've got the perspective of trees and houses below, you've just got the sea. It doesn't give you much perspective. You can lose your sense of how high you are over the sea. Anyway, I felt really pleased with myself because I did a nice landing. Throttles closed. Engines into fully fine pitch. So that gave you a braking effect. And that wonderful wowing sound, vrooming sound of the engines. And straight down the runway, as the speed comes off, you transfer from steering with the rudders to nose wheel steering. Come to a halt, turn round at the end because there was no taxiway. You turned round on the runway and came back up and turned into dispersal. I felt as pleased with myself as punch. I've always liked taxiing. I'm not scared when you're taxiing. You're on the ground. The aeroplane goes where you want it to, rather than where the air currents take it. And of course, you've got everybody watching. You've got the ground crew, you've got the air traffic controllers, you've got the guys wanting to reload the aeroplane, and you feel great, and you're giving out the orders and stopping the engines, switching everything down, and
pretty good.
Off to lunch. And the it had been a success, the first mission. I forget what we had for lunch, probably an egg banjo, which was a fried egg in a bun. over lunchtime, the squaddies loaded up the aeroplane again and went off for another one in the afternoon. And we did that for 10 days, about two trips a day. Difficult to fit in three trips because of the weather. You couldn't go early enough. You could do three trips from Kuching, where the border was closer, but you couldn't from Labuan. We flew the squad detachment lasted for some months, and we really did boost the fuel dropping. The station commander at the end, that's right. No, it was only a month. It was only a month, the first one. And we finished on the 22nd of November. And only a couple of sorties had been abandoned because of impossible weather. That's what it was. And when the weather was impossible, it really was impossible. It meant you couldn't see the valleys. You couldn't fly into the valley because you couldn't find it. And it would never get out again. There were some occasions when you waited you're pretty certain where you were, and you waited for the low cloud to clear until a hole appeared, and then you'd let down into that hole. Now, this is a dangerous procedure, but it was only because we had the Doppler that we were able to do it. I'm not sure whether the Beverleys did it. If they did, they were very brave, but we at least knew where we were, and by this time we got a feeling for some of the terrain. But probably not at this detachment, but later on we would let down through a hole. Terrifying. Cloud.
Tell me about how you do that.
Well, the Doppler will give you a ground track, the actual way you've gone. If you've got your maps developed enough so that you're pretty clear where you are, Long Somado, for example, you know the terrain, you've built up a navigator's map of the DZ, and you know there aren't any mountains in that immediate vicinity of the hole in the cloud, then you can spiral down through it. You hope that the hole is bigger than your turning circle, but sometimes it isn't. So there are these breathless moments as you're waiting to break out of the cloud. You can always climb back up again, providing the Doppler's telling you that you're going around a certain point. And sometimes you did climb back up again because you weren't coming out of the cloud and it wasn't safe. But we have got down through, and once you're under the cloud, then you can see the terrain and you can see the DZ and you can set up the circuit, which you know. You would never, ever do it at a new DZ or one you weren't experienced at. Of course, a tropical storm, you had no chance. If a tropical storm built up, you got caught in one, you just had to climb out. And on the Argosy, we had the cloud and collision warning radar. And the navigator was very good at telling you what was cloud and what was mountain. And they saved our lives several times by doing that, because we were flying on a heading which we reckoned was clear of mountains, and it wasn't. And we get this calm voice of the navigator saying, turn 20 degrees starboard. And you did. When the navigator told you to do that, you did it. Because it meant he knew that what was on his radar screen wasn't weather, it was mountain. The clouds had on the radar screen had a particular shade of light. It was sort of a difficult to describe, but it wasn't as solid an echo as a mountain.
So, but actually quite difficult to distinguish.
The navigators got good at it. Because they were building up, as the campaign went on, they built up a bigger and bigger knowledge of the terrain and amended the maps. On this first one, the station commander, Wing Commander Thomas AFC, said, "I'm very appreciative of the contribution the ARCSI has made and the excellent results achieved so early in the squadron's life. I shall call upon them again at reasonably short notice if operations demand." They did, and he did, often.
So, not too tricky. I shall ask it again. So during those 10 days that you talked about, were you doing the same drop zones, different drop zones?
We went to about a dozen, I suppose, different DZs. We went back to Barrio quite often, along Somado. The Long Acre, which was an airstrip by a river, much more straightforward to find. But we went also up into Saba, and that was a different affair. And we went to Pensiangan. Pensiangan is a different kettle of fish from all the others, in my view.
Why was that?
Well, it's on a river which called the Sambukan, which flows down into Indonesia. So it's downstream, which is your escape route, is straight into Indonesia. That's one thing. The second thing is that it's at 2,000 feet, and the hills, and it's where two rivers meet, and the hills around it go up to 4,000 feet. So you've got to get down from 4,000 feet to 2,000 feet, basically, and there isn't much room to do it. It's a highway for the Indonesians because it's a straightforward route up into Sabah. And so there's a lot of small arms fire. And people have been hit at Pensiangan. And the only aeroplane at that stage which could get there was the Argosy. The Beverly had no chance of getting down. The Valletta didn't have the range to get up there from Kuching. And the I think I'm doing the Valletta's a disservice there. I think the Valletta's had dropped at Pensiangan, but they couldn't drop the fuel. They couldn't drop the one-ton containers. So we were tasked with getting one-ton containers into Pensiangan, which was very difficult. The trouble was, if you tried to come downstream, you couldn't get down quick enough to get out straight and level with enough time to drop. If you came upstream, you did have time, but it was touch and go getting out again. And that's why the Beverleys couldn't drop there. The DZ at this time was right in the middle of the village, which was on the confluence of these two rivers. And it was really no bigger than a volleyball court. Well, so it seemed to me. It was sort of the village, the padang, the open area in the middle of the village. So you had to miss the rivers, miss the village, and hit the volleyball court. Well, that was a bit tricky. And on top of everything else, the weather at Pensiangan was always pretty rough, right up in the Sabah Highlands. Lots of cloud. And we went in first with Squadron Leader Bosleri, and he hadn't been there with the Beverly because the Beverly couldn't get in. So we tried upstream and couldn't get out again. We wouldn't have been able to get out again. We could never get down low enough because it was obvious to us that we were flying straight into the head of the valley. We tried downstream. No matter how close we got to the trees, and wallowing down with flaps down and coming down that valley to try and get straight and level, didn't work. So in the end, we had to go across. We had to go across the valley. It was the only way we could do it. But that meant that you couldn't see the DZ until you came over the last outcrop. So it required great skill on part of the navigator to get us straight on the right course.
Did you manage to drop anything successfully?
Yes, we did. By taking this route across, we managed to drop stuff in. I mean, some went in the river. The soldiers were under orders not to go into the river because, number one, the danger they'd be picked off by the Indonesians. The second was that two had been drowned doing that and swept away downstream in a raging torrent. So if it was in the river, it was lost forever. If it was in the jungle, it was pretty well lost too, because it would take them hours to hack a route through that thick jungle with machetes. They called them parangs in Borneo. Those long knives, cutting knives, take them forever to have got it, and so it was left to rot. And so you had to hit the DZ, yeah, just had to do it. And we managed it, and this was the procedure adopted for dropping at Penzhiangan. But then later on, they cut a new DZ, which was further up the hill, so that you had a chance of hitting it. But that first run was very, very difficult, and I remember it. I remember it. We took a soldier there, a soldier in the mess. First Lester's, I think it was, said, "Well, I was at Penzhiangan yesterday. It was a bloody awful drop." And so we told him a bit about it and suggested he should come up with us, and he did. And it was very good for relations that he'd gone up with the RAF crew to see what it was like dropping at Penzhiangan.
Just to see how difficult it was.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how much more you'd like on the supply dropping. It was like that for 2.5 years, 3 years, four, because after the peace treaty was signed, the Beverleys and the Arguses and the Hastings still had to go on dropping stuff to the soldiers who were still there, tidying up, and they dropped more tonnage in the last year than the ones before. I don't have a very good grasp of the figures, but that they kept an army which became 16,000 as the campaign went on, supplied in the field for 4 years by this methods. It was a bit different down in Kuching. Kuching had a town. At Labuan, when you weren't dropping, there wasn't a great deal to do. Tropical island it may have been, but I don't know whether you ever swum from a tropical island, but the sand flies and nasty biting things in the water, and you don't do a lot of that. There were these wonderful big lizards on the island, your size they were. And you go and see one of those monitor lizards. There was a war memorial to the Allied troops of the Second World War, which was a fairly evocative place, to say the least, which we visited. There was the town, Victoria, which was an old colonial port. Didn't have a great deal there to interest 23-year-old airmen officers. And there was nothing else. So that was, but then you didn't really need much more, you drank.
I wondered how it compared with your kind of high life previously.
Yeah, it was, you were away from all that. You were out on detachment. It's different on detachment. You've got a different spirit. You're living with the lads who are servicing the aeroplane. They're not living in some separate mess on the other side of Changi Airfield. We're all in there together. The aeroplane is, it's a more personal relationship with the aeroplane. You're trusting your life to it, and it's being looked after by you and your team in a remote location. So that probably is enough. Plus the alcohol. I mean, we drank. After a drop at Penzhiangan, came back to the bar and had a few a few Tiger beers. We drank Tiger beer. I drank too much Tiger beer, as I think I said earlier. But that's how you relaxed. And so it was different again. I think the family men had a bit of difficulty. At the end of our first detachment at Labuan, I was a bit gung-ho. I say, this is real stuff, old chap, you know. And I remember one of the navigators was very cynical about me, saying, I don't know, he said, look, mate, he said, I've just had to leave my wife and children in Changi and come out here and risk my bloody life in this awful weather, dropping in this silly bloody war, which shouldn't be in any case. Don't you tell me anything about the excitements, young whippersnapper, sort of attitude. And I could see his point of view now.
Yeah.
You see a bit of this now in now all the, these lads are having to go to Afghanistan and to Iraq. It's in Changi, everybody was on an accompanied tour. Out in Labuan and Kuching, it was unaccompanied, sharp end, dangerous, uncomfortable stuff. And I didn't mind that, because it was boys' own stuff. It was action adventure. But I was terrified by the flying, I have to admit. So if any of these people were terrified by the flying as well, and they were away from their families and loved ones, it must have been very difficult. And the boys on the ground crew as well. They weren't all boys. A lot of them were married men.
So there was a lot of drinking. Was there bad behaviour with it, or
no? Not in Labuan. It was all very gentlemanly. Probably because we were in the Memedi Club. The Shell were a very, they were more institutionalised than the Church of England, really.
What's this? I haven't heard of this. I mean, you mean Shell the company, but
Shell. Yep. In Brunei, there's a lot of oil, and the Labuan tropical island, they built their country club there, and Shell was it was run like the military really in those days. Douglas Bader was their company pilot. You often used to hear him on the airwaves out in Borneo. So you didn't misbehave in the Shell club, as far as I can remember. We misbehaved in Kuching quite outrageously. Kuching was a different kettle of fish. Down in Sarawak, a considerable base, barracks and port, so you had all three services there. You had the Malaysians as well. There were border scouts who went out with the SAS and Gurkha patrols. Royal Malaysian Air Force had a couple of Twin Pioneers as well, which they used to use for broadcasting treetop height flying with people speaking the local language, loudspeakers and leaflet dropping, that sort of thing. So there was all sorts going on in Kuching. There was a town, a river port town, a colonial river port town, lots of very, very good food. We used to go down every evening, as far as we probably didn't go every evening, but it felt we were there a lot, eating fresh chili crabs and mihoon and fried rice and prawns and chicken satay and tiger beer. Absolutely wonderful. It had the Sarawak Museum there, which was run by Tom Harrison. I didn't actually ever visit it, but a lot of people did. I went there later on. And it had girls, of course. You had to be a bit careful at the girls. There were enthusiastic amateurs, all right. There were Chinese nursing home and that attracted certainly a lot of the guys who were stationed there. Because at Kuching, the operations and ground staff were on 6-month unaccompanied tours at Kuching. My brother-in-law was there, so he tells me a bit about this. He told me about the Chinese nurses' home. So they had 6 months of adventure in the Far East, and they went back home again. So they had to experience everything they could, didn't they, before they went back home again. And there were, we had basha huts, which are wood and bamboo and banana leaf huts. I may be fantasizing about the banana leaf, but they were certainly made out of local materials. And one was the officer's mess, and then there was a volleyball court, and on the other side was the sergeant's mess. And one of our enterprising captains, John Horsfall, a youngish man, on his first captain's tour, lovely guy, he got permission from the station commander that we could fraternize. So one evening, we were in the officer's mess, drinking, playing cards, playing darts, and then all off for a late-night meal, and back again. And the next night, we'd be in the sergeant's mess, doing the same. It was wonderful. So we were all, there were terrific esprit de corps. And, of course, if we'd been drinking in the mess, then we go downtown and drink, we come back roaring drunk, and there's all kinds of shenanigans. People falling in monsoon drains, which is not as funny as it sounds. They're very, very deep, and you may not come out again. And people getting lost and that kind of thing. But we managed to turn up for flying in the morning. I can remember flying with terrible hangover. We used to have breakfast in the mess, and they did a terrific line in poached eggs. Now, poached eggs I love, and but I can still remember these poached eggs. Usually I didn't feel too well. And eggs, as you know, taste of what the chickens eat. And they eat an awful lot of garlic.
We talked about that
already. And we used to fly from there two or three times a day, so it's pretty intensive. You had to game watch the weather, but it was a little bit more predictable. The monsoon was, when the monsoon came, you had to be very, very careful. In the between the monsoons, you got quite a lot of still, clear weather. And we used to drop a lot of harness packs from Kuching, because the DZs generally were much smaller up on the border.
Can you just describe the harness packs for me?
Yes, they are. They were developed in Burma for dropping to the armies there, and they're 200 pounds, so they could be manhandled by two or three guys. They've got a smaller parachute on them. The parachute on a 1 ton is 42-foot diameter, which is a fair old parachute. On the harness pack, it's a quarter of that, and they go down. They're pushed out of the side doors, literally pushed. Red light on, green light on, push them out. But because they're smaller, you have to drop many more of them. And we would go round and round. We'd take something like 40 harness packs, which meant 20 circuits. And that was all right if you were, if the weather was okay. If the weather was looking dodgy, it sometimes got a bit difficult. By this time, I was doing a lot of the flying. The captains, number one, they'd all got experience. They were all checked out. And so it was part of their job to let the co-pilot fly. Otherwise, if he had to fly in an emergency, he'd be in some trouble. And the captain would actually go downstairs and watch the action down in the cabin whilst you were flying the circuit upstairs.
Why
which
is that?
A tremendous boost to your confidence. Well, it was interesting for the captain to see the action downstairs, which he hadn't seen.